This talk was given by Ber Gokhan Bonabacher at the Zen Center of New York City. Gokhan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, "There are both wholesome and unwholesome seeds in our mind field, sown by ourselves and by our parents, schooling, ancestors, and society. If you plant wheat, wheat will grow. If you act in a wholesome way, you will be happy. If you act in an unwholesome way, you will water seeds of craving, anger, and violence in yourself and in others. The practice of mindfulness helps us identify all the seeds in our consciousness, and with that knowledge, we can choose to water only the ones that are the most beneficial. As we cultivate the seeds of joy and transform seeds of suffering in ourselves, understanding, love, and compassion will flower." So he says that these seeds, wholesome and unwholesome, are in all of us. They're in all of us. Some of them come from our own experience, our own actions. This is the karma that we own is ours. Some of it comes from others, from our society, as he says, from our schooling, from our parents, all the different people that have had influence on us. In a way, it's kind of slipped in there without us noticing sometimes. And we own this too. This is ours too. I think that the last time I was here, I mentioned a line from this paragraph. It's been on my mind. This teaching that is so simple. Simply give energy, water, that which is wholesome. And don't give energy to that which is not wholesome. Cultivate the habits that are wholesome. Loosen the grip. Lessen the habits that are unwholesome. And these terms, wholesome and unwholesome, are used a lot in the earlier teachings of Buddhism. I think that we can understand them as skillful and unskillful. So we talk about skillful means. What is skillful? What is helpful? What is loosening our grip, our lessening suffering? And what is not? What is unskillful? What is it that causes pain? Or we could think about it as harmonious and not harmonious. What is it that brings us into harmony? What actions, what ways of using our speech, our mind, is harmonious, creates harmony, returns to harmony? And which ways are not harmonious? I was looking this up to try and find a definition and sort of some, and I saw a little something from Joseph Goldstein, who's a teacher in the Insight tradition, American teacher. And there was just a comment. He was just saying, you know, this is so simple. It's like what we teach kindergartners. Right? Just don't do things that don't hurt each other. Right? Do things that are helpful, that are nice to each other. It's so simple. And yet, look around, right? Look at your own life, how hard it can be to do that, simply to do that. This morning, up at the monastery right now, there are a group of students who are receiving the precepts. A number of them are people who you know, are practitioners here, who are here often. And so they've spent the week sewing their raksu. So the black sort of bibs that some people are wearing are called a raksu, which you sew, and as you sew, you chant, taking refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha, in the three treasures. And there's also some time during the week spent with the teacher, so in this case with Shugen Roshi, examining the precepts, the moral and ethical teachings. And, you know, during that week, there, even for those of us who aren't participating, there's a way in which it, just like you can kind of feel that that's what's happening. that there is this dedicated, this focus on the vows that they are sort of leading up to the vows that they're taking this morning. The vows to practice the precepts, to take up this practice, these practices in their life, to make that a focus, a priority. The what are called the three pure precepts, which are the sort of before the precepts start to be sort of explicated a little bit, are to do good for others, and not to do evil. So again, so simple, so direct. Do things that are helpful for others, that are good, and don't do things that are to cause pain, that hurt others, that hurt ourselves. And again, so simple, and how often we go astray. And I've also been reading a book by Master Sheng Yen, who was a Chinese master who taught quite a bit here in the United States, and died about 10 years ago, I think. And what I'm reading is just kind of an introduction to Zen. In Chinese, it's called Chan. And you know, I was struck, and there's some similar language from Thich Nhat Hanh, who again is an Asian teacher who comes from a very traditional training and then taught in the West. And that there's more of an emphasis on the precepts at the beginning of training, at the beginning of practice. And so in some Buddhist traditions, you would start by, before you started meditating, you would practice the precepts. And there are five precepts that are sort of which are where you start and are often taken up by lay students. And so these are precepts that are really meant to be practiced in sort of the everyday world. They are to not kill, to not misuse sexuality, to not steal, to not lie, and to not use intoxicants, which is often explained. The sort of the main purpose of that is when we use intoxicants, we break the other precepts, right? Because we get lost. It fosters delusion when we cloud the mind. But that the precepts are emphasized at the beginning because we kind of need them to, we have to kind of settle in our life so that we can settle, then turn to meditation and be settled enough to settle, right? To see our mind. In our tradition, so some of you came here for the first time this morning, you may have no experience with Buddhism, and the first thing that you get is instruction in Zazen. But we also take up the precepts right from the beginning. So I happen to be mentioning them in this talk on your first day. They go together. And I think that's sort of what I've been hearing from Thich Nhat Hanh, from Sheng Yen, Master Sheng Yen. They can't be separated. Right, our actions off of the cushion, sort of the rest of the day, can't be separated from our practice on the cushion. And also, sort of in me this week and these last couple of weeks was leading up to, and then we had a meeting yesterday, a Sangha meeting, a community meeting at the monastery that had been scheduled for some time, actually, to particularly to look at the misuse of power by Buddhist teachers that has happened so much in the West and has happened. There have been some things in other sanghas that have come out recently that have been quite disturbing. But we're also very much looking at our own lineage, at misuse of power, of authority in our own lineage. Some of it having to do with the history of the temple, of this place of practice. And we had a really good, healthy conversation about all of this, looking at questions of, how can someone who is enlightened, and as Shugen Roshi was, sort of laying this out, he was like, let's start with just, that they do have insight, right? There are teachers who may be teaching who don't have really some insight to draw on. But teachers who do have insight, how can they do things that are harmful? How can they have deep understanding of mind and then cause harm, break the precepts? How is it that they can still get caught in their desires, in their anger, be blinded by them? And so a lot of the discussion yesterday was kind of wrestling with the complexity of our humanity, and seeing that complexity in our teachers, in people who we may have thought had transcended that, had gone beyond that somehow. And there was some discussion about the danger of that, the danger of how we do idealize teachers. We want them to be perfect. We want to believe that they're perfect, that they're that they have kind of transcended these aspects of humanity that we wrestle with in ourselves. We want to think that there's a way in which they're done, that enlightenment means that we're done. Right? We sort of like, it's like somehow we'll someday, if when I'm really, you know, sitting hard, I'm just going to like pass through this door and then it's all going to be different. And so there were expressions of disappointment, right, of hurt, to learn things about our own teachers. Daito Roshi, our founder. And for some people, they were, this, a lot of people didn't know Daito, but so didn't know him in person. And I think that in a sense, there's a way in which we kind of need to be disappointed, that that's a place of maturing, actually, in our practice, maturing and kind of understanding ourselves and our teachers, so that we're not making them into something that they're not. I've been remembering how the times when Daito Roshi, who was my first teacher and who really helped me greatly, helped me to return to life in a real way, that the times when I was hurt by him or saw, there were a couple of times when I felt like I saw what he was blind to, and I saw that he was suffering because of that blindness. And that those experiences for me were really important, were transformative, because they forced me to see that I wasn't, I wasn't at the monastery, I wasn't practicing, I wasn't giving so much of my life to practice, to the Dharma, because of Daito. Right? It was for me. It was for my life. And I had, by that point of seeing these blindnesses in Daito, I had practiced enough that I trusted my own practice, and it helped me to see that I could stand on my feet, and that didn't take away, it didn't deny how much he had helped me and continued to help me. The blindness that I saw in him didn't erase the clarity that I also knew was true. And we can learn from our teachers, both from their clarity and from their places where they are not clear. We should, right? In the same way that we should learn from our elders, both by seeing their wisdom and by seeing where they're not being wise, and where we can do better, we can learn from their mistakes. So Thich Nhat Hanh says that we have all of these seeds in us. We have seeds of anger, of desire, of insecurity, habits of distraction. We all have our ways of kind of numbing or checking out, of exiting, shutting down. He says the practice of mindfulness helps us identify all the seeds in our consciousness. And with that knowledge, we can choose to water only the ones that are the most beneficial. We have to see these seeds in ourself, these parts of ourself, these habits that we have. We have to want to see, and we don't always want to see. We want to not be uncomfortable, right? We want to not feel pain, not suffer, not be afraid. But there's a way in which that can be different than being free, trying to get away, trying to not experience things rather than is different than trying to be free, than being free. And so I've been, and I'll come back to this, but I feel like I'm like just sort of seeing that, and that you know, we don't get away, right? That's not freedom, actually. We don't get away from all of this. There is insight. There is direct seeing of the nature of our mind, the nature of things, emptiness, impermanence. And there is transformation that comes from that. There's loosening that comes from that, letting go. And we have to keep practicing. There are these seeds in us still. Desires are endless. We have to keep practicing. Keep seeing. Keep actively working to water what is wholesome and not what is unwholesome. One of the things that Shugen Roshi talked about yesterday was just about speaking about himself as a student, that he is still a student, and the importance of that. The importance of that. That's one of the dangers, I think, in us idealizing our teachers, is that we make it harder for them to stay being a student. Right? Because they naturally kind of believe some of what we're projecting onto them. Thich Nhat Hanh says, when illuminated by the light of mindfulness, delusions are less able to manifest in unwholesome acts of our body, speech, and mind. Delusion operates in darkness, but not in light. So we have to illuminate kind of the dark corners, the shadows of our mind, of our experience. And again, we have to want that. Right? Even when it's not so comfortable. I feel like I've been seeing that we've been looking at power and at patriarchy and how I can like just see it, how this conditioning, and it's like, it's hard to see that, seeing that, what is so in me that I can't see it. It's hard to see. It's hard to see that seeing that and loosening that will be liberating. That illuminating that will be liberating. Is liberating. And so I've also been thinking about how do we live, or sort of another way to put all of this, how do we live with our imperfection, with our karma? How do we be free in the midst of our own complexity, and the complexity of everyone else that we're living with, interacting with, working with. Again, seeing that we don't, the point isn't to try and get away from it, to escape it. And I think that when we think that we can, that's actually trouble. That's actually causing problems. And it's natural. I think we just do that. We want to get away. So how do we be free in the midst of suffering and desire and complication? What does it mean to be free? Right? What do we think that means? And so we chant, desires are numberless. I vow to put an end to them. But will we ever put an end to them? I've seen some teachers talk about, you know, so really our vow is to lessen them, to loosen them, to have fewer, to not be so caught, controlled by them. It seems to be very difficult to be with our own direct experience. But that's actually what we're practicing, is to be right with whatever our experience is, not getting away from it. What happens when we don't turn away, but we get closer, closer? I was talking recently with one of the residents of the monastery who had kind of gotten he'd broken our code of sort of our, you know, the guidelines that we live by at the monastery. And it was, you know, the situation was a little messy. It wasn't just him. But I was talking to him and he was saying, you know, that he was, had been really trying to pay attention to, you know, when he was looking and taking, looking at what he had done and the effects that that had had on, in his mind, and taking, trying to take responsibility, just trying to see that, taking responsibility for that. And when he was talking, when his mind was going to thinking about someone else who was sort of involved, and seeing, oh, that he could spend all of his time in his mind sort of cultivating that, criticizing the other person, being angry at the other person. And then he was really trying to work on not cultivating that, that he couldn't do anything about that, that his work was his work, was working with his mind. I was moved by that, impressed by that, that that's taking responsibility for what we can take responsibility for. And so I found this this sutra that's called "To Be Cultivated and Not to Be Cultivated." I thought this was interesting, and a couple of things in particular I thought were interesting and helpful. So I'm sort of going to summarize some of this and then look at these couple of parts that I thought were particularly interesting. And so it's simply called "To Be Cultivated and Not to Be Cultivated." And so this is a teaching of the Buddha. And so he runs through, there is bodily conduct, verbal conduct, mental conduct, inclination of mind, acquisition of perception, acquisition of view, and acquisition of individuality. And then in each of these, there are two kinds. There is that which should be cultivated and that which should not be cultivated. And so with bodily conduct, there is the one to be cultivated or the other to not be cultivated. And so these first three are basically the precepts. So in bodily conduct, killing, stealing, misconduct in sexual pleasure, sensual pleasure, he actually says. In this conduct, there is that which should be cultivated that leads to wholesome states of mind, and that which should not be cultivated that leads to unwholesome states of mind. The same with verbal conduct. So speaking, so lying, speaking in ways that divide or that hurt or that is just gossip. And there's that which should be cultivated and that which should not be cultivated. With mental conduct, so greed, covetousness, is the way he puts it, with ill will or anger, there is that which should be cultivated and that which is not should be, that should not be cultivated. And so, again, these are the precepts, basically, very similar to what we take up. And, you know, these are practice precepts. I remember when I took the precepts with Daito Roshi, I really wanted him to explain more, to like tell me more what I was supposed to do. And he was like, these are yours. That's not, these are yours. And that was actually, once I'd taken the precepts, that was really powerful. Like, oh, I'm empowered now to practice these myself, in my own mind, in my own life. And so I say that because there was, as I was reading the sutra and sort of studying it, trying to understand it, the Buddha doesn't explain very much. He just says, so there is what should be cultivated and what should not be cultivated. Cultivate that which leads to wholesome states. Don't cultivate that which doesn't lead to wholesome states. But then what I thought was really helpful is where he starts to talk about inclination of mind. So that we can cultivate an inclination of mind that is covetous, that is greedy. An inclination of mind that is qualified by ill will. He says someone has ill will and abides with their mind imbued with ill will. So what is it to have a mind that is imbued with ill will? We see this, how this happens in our own mind. What is it to cultivate such a mind? A few weeks ago, or over a number of weeks, actually, we had a... earlier this year, we installed some new solar panels at the monastery. And I pay the bills. And I realized as I was looking at the bills from the power company that they weren't changing as a result of these solar panels we'd installed. And so I started to look into that, and I called the company that installed them. I say, hey, what's going on? I called the power company, saying, what's going on? We're not getting credit for all this power that we're generating. And it was one of these, like, nobody wanted to, you know, everyone sent me to someone else. And I was spending a lot of time trying to, you know, work through the phone tree of, like, getting to an actual person and then getting a person who had actually talked to me and actually had some responsibility. And it was very frustrating. And I saw how, when I was not doing that, so I was just, like, when I'd be sitting zazen or walking from one building to another, that I was having these, that I was angry at the power company, right? And that I kept going, that would come up. And I realized that I was cultivating that, right? I was feeding that, it, you know, this was something that was happening in my life, but that I was also then using it somehow. I was imbuing my mind with this anger. I was cultivating it. And then I saw this most clearly. At one point I was on the phone. I had, you know, gotten through to a supervisor, and I could feel the temptation to just let all of this anger come out. And I could feel it would be thrilling to just let it out. But I also heard him on the other, you know, on the other side. And it's like, he must get that all day, right? And he's actually being really nice to me, right? It's not him. And like, what is that? Where does that anger come from, right? It's not like commensurate with the poor guy on the other, you know, who's just trying to help me, commensurate with the situation. It's an inclination of mind that is imbued with ill will. And of course, as the Buddha said, such inclination of mind causes unwholesome states to increase and wholesome states to diminish. And so I saw that in my own mind, right? When I was cultivating this anger towards the power company, I was creating, you know, I was creating suffering. I was creating an unwholesome state in my mind, in my being. And of course that comes out. And then he talks about acquisition of perception. Here someone is covetous and abides with their perception imbued with covetousness. They have ill will and they abide with their perception imbued with ill will. So we abide with our perception imbued with ill will if that's what we're cultivating. So we actually see our perception is colored, right? We see with anger, with greed, when that's what we're cultivating. And the last two are a little bit more kind of technical and talking about right view and acquisition of individuality. But I, you know, what I hear in that, what I understood in that is, you know, what we cultivate is what we become. Right? We acquire that individuality, that sort of existence, if that is what we're cultivating. So what are we cultivating? How do we want to use our mind? And so I think it's always helpful to bring the teachings back to our zazen practice, and the instruction that we receive in zazen. And so a part of the really important part of that instruction, important part of zazen practice is the practice of not pushing away and of not fueling, not adding. Because these are the things that we cultivate. This is what we do with our mind constantly. And so to really pay attention to that in our zazen, see how that our zazen practice is what the Buddha is talking about in this not cultivating. What Thich Nhat Hanh is talking about in watering what is wholesome and not what is unwholesome. And so if we push away, if we deny the anger that we experience, if we try not to experience that, that's not the instruction in zazen. That's not working with it. It's not helping. That's not bringing awareness to it. shining the light of mindfulness on it, and not indulging, not fueling. Right? When something is pleasurable, of course we want to, it's natural, we want that to continue. And so to see how we do that in our mind and zazen, to see how long we can spend in a fantasy, and to learn to see that we don't, that we can remove, we can sort of pull energy back from that, not fuel that. So, you know, I was thinking a week or so ago, I knew this talk was coming. I was like, I really didn't know where we would be on this day, where I would be, what would have happened in the election, what would have happened in the meeting that we had yesterday. And so, again, feeling and sort of, as I was thinking about that, and then, you know, as things unfolded, just feeling how we can, you know, the beginning of our meeting yesterday, I was, you know, we were talking about, you know, so how are we going to, how do we do this? How do we do this together? And talking about how, you know, trusting that we can hold the complexity of our lives. There's a way in which we don't have any choice. Right, we live in the complexity of our lives, and so we do have a choice. Right? We do have a choice, because we can push away, we can ignore, we can check out. But how do we live in the complexity of our lives in a way that is more free, that is direct and truthful, because it's not turning away? Why is it so hard to be with our direct experience, to really be with our direct experience, whether it's whatever it is? It's like when we get really close, it's uncomfortable. Why is that? And so to let go of the idea of escaping, of escaping this complexity, of escaping desire, but rather right here to turn towards our mind so that we can see and feel and know directly for ourselves what it is, what should be in our own mind cultivated, and what should be in our own mind not cultivated, for our own sake and for others.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.